if you recall, last year, we went over provisions on justification regarding self-defense, use of force by peace officers in making an arrest, use of force in defense of property. Well, this is the leftovers here on page 11. There are four provisions. The first is entitled Justification Performance of Public Duty. And it simply provides on line 10 that conduct which would otherwise constitute an offense is justified when it's required or authorized by law or by judicial decree, judgment, or order. What type of things are we talking about here? In Title 12, for example, there's a provision that says in serving a search warrant, I believe the officer may knock down a door in serving the warrant. This provision says, well, in knocking down the door, he hasn't committed criminal mischief, which is a crime. So it's authorized
even
by...
Even if knocking down was illegal, he hasn't committed any crime.
Well, he had to be
It's got to be required or authorized by law. Oh, no. It had to be pursuant to that statute, and if it says you can do it, or judgment, serving a process, for example. And it's basically when it's a strict liability type thing. In other words, in fact, has to be authorized by law. There are two exceptions. The first one, in terms of strict liability, in other words, if it turns out that it's not authorized by law, there's no defense. Subsection B provides two exceptions. The first is when a person reasonably believes your conduct to be authorized by decree, judgment, or order, or in the lawful execution of legal process, but it turns out that there was no jurisdiction of the court in or tribunal. I'm not sure whether we should have that.
I don't think there is a tribunal.
I thought I got that out. Okay, the court didn't have jurisdiction in ordering process to be served, and you thought it did. Well, if you act under that reasonable belief, you're still affording defense. On line 19, subsection 2, when a person is requested to assist a peace officer in the performance of his duties, and the person reasonably believes the conduct to be required or authorized by the peace officer, if he helps the officer, for example, in knocking the door down, he is also afforded the defense, but again, it has to be a reasonable belief. It's a very broad provision, and again, it really refers to other regulations, statutes, and it says that if it's required under the statute or authorized, you're allowed to do it. For example, public safety, one of the things they're required to do is prevent crime. Well, one of the things involved in that is investigating crime, and when they go into a certain crime scene, they have to have their guns drawn sometimes, and this says basically it's not an offense. Now, when it gets to the use of force, say to making an arrest or to prevent an escape, it's covered under the specific provisions. But this is a very broad general provision. The next section is 230, and this section deals with the use of force under special relationships, and I believe there are six provisions, and this was one of the last things considered by the subcommittee. And here we are talking about the use of non-deadly force. Non-deadly force is all force short of the deadly variety. And all the provisions refer to when to the extent reasonably necessary. So even though non-deadly force would include hitting someone around pretty seriously, it has to be reasonably necessary. It doesn't automatically give you a grant to beat someone up just for helping someone up. The first section is parents, guardians, or other persons entrusted with the care and supervision of a minor or incompetent person. And it provides that the parent, guardian, or other person entrusted with the care of those people may use reasonable and appropriate non-deadly physical force upon the minor or incompetent person when and to the extent reasonably necessary and appropriate to promote the welfare of the minor or incompetent person, simply disciplining. Under existing law, we recognize that a homicide committed in correcting a child is excusable. We don't refer to, of course, just slapping a child. This is a general provision dealing with non-deadly force in promoting the welfare of the minor. And it could only be done by parents, guardian, or other persons entrusted with the care of those people. Now, it also refers to incompetent persons. And this is an important provision only because the commission never finished it. And it was really left up to me to come back. What I did, well, what it was is the last thing we did. And I came back with a draft, and I gave it out to the commission. I said, if anyone has any problems with it, call me back with it. And one person called me back on it, and I'll tell you the concern. Okay. We turn back to page 11, it says you may use force upon incompetent person. Okay, the question is, who has the burden of establishing incompetency? What is an incompetent person, essentially? And we try to deal with that on page 13, line 6, subsection B. And it says, a person who raises a defense under this section and claims that the person upon whom force was used was incompetent has the burden of establishing, and we're going to add, on the, we left this out, and we're going to add in the draft, by preponderance of the evidence, that at the time force was used, the person upon whom the force was used was hospitalized under Title 47, which is mentally ill or insane, or could have been hospitalized upon a court order under 4730070.
Didn't
that stretch things? Well, okay, now that's what I'm going to bring up. Okay, that's a fairly limited concept. It's because you're referring to mentally ill and insane, and it requires that you must find that the person is mentally ill and is a danger to himself or others. Okay, it's been suggested that that may be, I mean, too restrictive. I'm not too sure how you're approaching it, but it's been suggested that that's too restrictive, that you want to authorize not only force against mentally ill people in terms of protecting them or promoting their welfare, restraining them, for example. You may want to broaden that to the concept of incapacitated persons. And there's a definition of incapacitated persons, but that may be too restrictive, too broad. And the definition of incapacitated persons appears in Title 13.
Under alcohol.
And it says, any person who's impaired by reason of mental illness, okay, mental deficiency, then you get, okay, mental illness and mental deficiencies, I react okay to that, because I think it's broader than the concept of mental illness. But then it goes on to say physical illness or disability, advanced age, chronic use of drugs, chronic intoxication, or other cause except minority, to the extent that he lacks sufficient understanding or capacity to make or communicate responsible decisions concerning his person.
If you're drunk.
Right, so what you want to do, if you feel that it's too restrictive, the definition of mentally ill and insane, which is Title 47, you may want to use the definition, say an incapacitated person, and define it as a person who's impaired by reason of mental illness, mental deficiency, to the extent that he lacks sufficient understanding. Wow. So I can bring back alternatives for markup. But this problem, of course, was, as I'm aware of, Alaska is the only state that's addressed itself to this problem, because all other codes say you may use force upon an incompetent person, but they never define what an incompetent person is and who has the burden of establishing incompetency. We attempted to do so, but it didn't get the same type of review that everything else did just because of time limitations. So it's going to, you know, I feel it needs some more work.
What kind of treatment are we talking about? Maybe I'm missing something. I mentioned last time, I'm making all these confident people. What,
yep.
What do you see as being kind of forces on them?
I think
that, restraints on
yeah,
them,
yeah.
Give them brain jobs.
Well, that's covered under, the brain thing would be covered under 47, I believe, under Title 47. I think it's like, see, what the way I see it is it covers two types of conduct, and the question is how broad you want to do it. Number one, the people that are been hospitalized under 47 that are mentally ill, I believe there's a section in that provision already justifying restraint of those people. But the other problem is, well, what happens when you haven't been hospitalized and you're home with, say, the incompetent person is a 37-year-old retarded person, and he's living with his parents, and there is going to be a certain amount of force, perhaps that may be necessary to restrain him, and you want to provide a defense. Now, it could be argued that you don't even have to deal with it at all, but it has been dealt with in the revised codes, and we've attempted to try to define what incompetent is, and again, that's going to need some work, I think. But it's putting the straitjacket in the hospital. It's also you're straining it in within your own home. So it's a tricky question. So subsection two is a very controversial one, and it was dealt with again at the last meeting. This whole section was, and it deals with use of force by teachers. Okay, and it says that a teacher may only use physical, non-deadly physical force upon a student when it is authorized by school rules and regulations. And it has to be reasonable and appropriate non-deadly force. When to the extent reasonably necessary and appropriate to maintain order in the school or classroom, and when the use of that force is consistent with the welfare of the students. Give you a little background on this. When we considered it, there was initially a requirement that it be with the consent of the parents. In other words, before the teacher could use the physical force, the parents had to consent. The commission initially adopted that approach, but then later reversed itself and eliminated the consent requirement. The important thing to note, of course, is that in order to be justified, it has to be authorized by school rules and regulations. And I guess what the commission had in mind was that, in fact, there are significant numbers of parents that don't want physical force in any circumstances to be used against their child, and the school board is willing to set up a school accommodating them. They can have by school regulation say it's not authorized in this school or classroom.
How to show that that's consistent, telling your kid is consistent with the welfare of the kid?
That was my proposal, that we put a period right after children in online class.
Great. I mean, is there a way to show that?
I think what they're referring to, I think, and I think they're trying to stress that you're not beating up, you're not using physical force against students simply for the sake of beating them up.
Well, the argument is, it's this simple, is that you got somebody that's being obnoxious, right? Nobody can learn in the school because somebody's disrupting the whole classroom and the kid wants to be a nice kid, and so you have to club him to make him settle down, and then you can conduct your class in a manner where everybody can learn. But as long as he's running around and swinging from the lamps or whatever, that you can't teach him anything. So it is for his welfare. That's how the argument is. And whether you buy that or not, the student.
Some states don't use that term.
But that's a general argument that I've heard people use. That you've got to have order in the classroom, or else you can't teach kids. You know, it disrupts things.
That twisted. The only thing that I'd say after children, you put a period, it's in the welfare of the rest of the children, in the welfare of the school, that we spank his rear end. Not necessarily for his welfare.
Well, see, some people are maintaining.
Some will argue that it is very
well, yeah, that's what I. People are arguing that it's not only for.
It's a student.
Every student.
It's a student. I think really everyone.
Yeah. But then, you know, a lot of people argue very forcefully that, you know, their kid is their kid, and somebody else doesn't have the right to beat him unless they want to allow that.
It's a code, though. Give the school boards the right to pass a regulation. You can do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Leave the local school boards.
Yeah. Exactly.
They want to do that. I just didn't like that they have to write a regulation that it is welfare necessarily. I think the school is welfare.
Well, it doesn't really. I don't think the regulation has to say that. I think, though, that the teacher's use of it, he has to basically judge it in the individual situation, whether is this the appropriate time to use physical force. I mean, can I maybe do it by simply saying go to the dean's office or whatever?
Yeah, my dad said this to hurt me more than good.
Well,
so you're
yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Whose welfare are we talking about? I couldn't understand what you're talking about. I kept thinking that was the welfare of the other students.
Well, I think it is. I think you were talking about the students. And the question is, does it include the student that you're using physical force on, or is it just the other students?
Well, Larry's got a good point. Larry's got a good point that has an ask on the students.
Yeah.
I thought he said it's consistent with the welfare of the students. But he says students, so that pretty well takes care of them.
It's still the question, though, is it, does it include the student that you're using?
You're collaborating, yeah. Or the rest of the class.
You can say with the other students if you want to. But it should also be consistent with his welfare, I think. But maybe that's the
problem. Well, if it's consistent with the welfare of the other students, it's probably consistent with his welfare, too. But the word other might be make it more comfortable.
Okay, subsection 3 deals with the use of force, use of non-deadly force in a correctional facility to maintain order, and it simply says that the superintendent or other entrusted official of the correctional facility may use reasonable non-deadly physical force as authorized by the regulations adopted by the Division of Health and Social Services. It's leaving it really up to the division to establish it, and the commission is. There's no way the commission can determine all the circumstances in a correctional facility when it is justifiable.
The corrections testified before the commission.
Well, we had Wes Abdul Houston was there.
Did he have any objections to this?
Well, he wasn't. The last time we took it up, he wasn't at the meeting.
What do you think he did?
Oh no, this is pretty important. if he did, I'd be very surprised.
He read the police report.
Yeah.
Bill, do you want to?
Yeah.
Questions at all?
Okay, the fourth one It's dealing with common persons and common carriers who are responsible for the safety of the passengers. And it simply said that such a person may use reasonable non-deadly physical force when to the extent reasonably necessary to maintain order on a common carrier. The best example I can give you is the drunk on the people mover in Anchorage, and he's harassing the passengers. Let's assume it's not a situation where it's a self-defense. You know, it's not using force, it's just being obnoxious or whatever. This allows the bus driver to basically put him off the bus system. So,
force.
Yeah, it allows reasonable force, and I think that reasonable force there would be to eject the person. It also may deal with situations that probably be more important in terms of airplane travel, where you have stewardess, you say you have an obnoxious or unruly person on board, or someone is, well, hijacking would be covered, but you know, someone perhaps may be screaming there's a bomb going to go off or something like that, and you have to restrain the person so he doesn't upset the fellow passengers. This allows you to use reasonable force. It's, again, it's a common provision to revise codes. Subsection 5 I enjoy discussing because it's somewhat interesting. It says a person may use reasonable non-deadly physical force to prevent a suicide. Now, the thing that I like pointing out is to say, you should know that the code does not allow you to use deadly force to prevent a suicide. So, and this is solely a value judgment. That's all it is. It's just a value judgment, and it's saying that if you believe imminently that there is someone's going to commit suicide, you may use reasonable non-deadly force to prevent that. And again, it's common to revise codes. We also have a policy in the law that discourages suicides. In other words, if you aid someone in committing a suicide, you're going to be guilty of manslaughter under the code. This is consistent with that approach. So,
do you see cases where to prevent people from committing suicide, you could kill them? Were they going to take the last
brother? Oh, that's sure. Yes, and that's in defense of third person. In other words, you could have a situation where the guy has a hand grenade and he's going to blow himself up, and there's a lot of other people around him. There you may use deadly force because it's in defense of the other people.
So you have the police many times around the situation with the drunk man and the whole family's in the road, and he's got the police in advance and says he's going to kill himself and shoot everybody in the family. You got the question as to whether the blast is before the police.
It wouldn't be under this section. And the important thing is that the more specific provisions on defense of third persons would govern, and that allows deadly force. And I say that deadly force is governed by other provisions of this chapter. For example, correctional officers. Here we say they may use non-deadly force to maintain order in the correctional facility. Well, there's another provision in this chapter that says he may use deadly force to prevent an escape. So this deals with non-deadly force. There are other provisions that deal with deadly force. And to be authorized deadly, had to justify your hypo, would be justified. Oh, sure. That would be covered too. Okay. Subsection 6. Subsection 6 is really fairly simple. I mean, in the sense that currently now we have Good Samaritan statutes that say that you're not liable in a civil prosecution if you render aid at the assistance, at the scene of an accident, unless it's intentional misconduct. This simply says you're not liable for a crime either. In other words, most instances of civil liability may also give rise to criminal liability. For example, you give artificial respiration to the person. That in fact, could be viewed as an assault, a simple assault. And this says that, essentially, it says any person who renders aid the scene of an emergency is justified using physical non-deadly force in administering treatment if it is with the consent of the patient, or if the patient is a minor incompetent person with the consent of the parent, guardian, or the person trusted with his care or supervision, or subsection B on page 13. If it's an emergency situation, the person administering the treatment reasonably believes that no one is competent to consent, can be consulted, and under the circumstances, a reasonable person would consent. In other words, come to the scene of an accident, there's someone lying on the side of the road bleeding, there's no one else around, he can give consent. This says, go ahead, you know, give the treatment. Go.
I'm still curious as to why that you say a licensed physician, paramedic, or registered nurse.
And then
you go on to say anybody else.
Okay, yeah, let me
say a plumber and a fisherman and everybody else.
Okay, the reason is, and it was brought up, was that we want to make it clear to doctors that they should feel that they should act under those circumstances. And by I agree, you know, generally you would want to say any person. But it was felt that we should make it clear that we mean, you know, specifically we're saying to doctors, those are the persons we want to encourage here, we want to mention it. So I agree, there's no, that's why I said it essentially authorizes any person. Although really the any person provision only covers when it's emergency care at the scene of an emergency. In other words, you're not, you don't want to authorize, I think, myself to go and give medical treatment to someone who just comes in to see me, because I think that would maybe be the unauthorized practice of medicine or something, if there's a prohibition against that. You're trying to say private persons, yeah, you may give emergency treatment. Doctors and physicians, of course, may give it in any circumstances. So there actually, there is a reason behind that. Okay. Subsection 240 and 250 are two more defenses to prosecutions. They're both affirmative defenses. They're somewhat, I think they're fairly important. First one is duress. Duress is a defense that justifies the use of, I mean, justifies a crime if the person was basically forced. He didn't have any choice but to engage in that conduct. And currently, the defense of duress is recognized in Alaska. It is not codified, but at least two cases that we were able to tell in Anchorage, at least, the defense had been raised. And one was Duncan Webb, and the other, I've got the sites later on. But what it says is that, number one, it's an affirmative defense, and would cover the type of conduct where someone points a gun at you and says, drive my getaway car. And basically, society made a determination that under those situations, it's reasonable for the person to drive the getaway car if a reasonable person in a situation would have been unable to resist the order. And what the provision says is that in any prosecution, it is an affirmative defense that the person engaged in the conduct because he was coerced to do so by the use or threatened use of unlawful physical force upon him or a third person. Okay, third person, you're holding someone's daughter, you call them up to have to kill her unless you go to the bank and walk in with this note that says, you know, give me all your money. Which force or threatened force a reasonable person in this situation would have been unable to resist. Okay, then it goes on to say, the defense of duress is not available when a person recklessly places himself in a situation in which it is probable that he will be subject to duress. What does that cover? It covers a situation where you go in with, say you're going to rob a bank, and you decide all of a sudden with another person, you decide, I'm not going to go ahead with it, I'm going to back out. Well, your accomplice decides he needs you, and he points the gun at you, and he says, okay, you better do this or I'm going to blow you away. This simply says the defense is not recognized because the person recklessly placed himself in a situation in which it was probable that he would be subject to duress. And the commentary gives that example of the type of conduct we are intending to exclude from the defense.
The proponent of affirmative now is that the proponent says that the evidence is only the defendant to show that he was in a situation. But where the wife says, I drove the car, I did that, committed these crimes because I was afraid of my husband. Mm-hmm.
Well,
he has a terrific temper, and I didn't want to act. Is that was you don't see that as where she had ample time to call the police, go to the police, or do whatever. You don't see somebody just going around saying, I was.
Oh, every case?
Well, women say that they're scared to death of my husband. I was scared of this character. You remember the mafia?
Okay.
He told me that I don't want to get across with those characters, and he told me to keep my mouth shut, so therefore you're charging me with concealing the crime. Is that correct?
Well, I don't think
if I could show that I was frightened.
No, it's not enough that you were frightened. Number one, it has to be actual use of physical force or threat. You have to give a specific threat. It doesn't say express or reply, which some provisions do. Number two, it's not enough that you were frightened. A reasonable person in the situation of the wife would have been unable to resist. And it's, I think, it allows the jury to say, well, what would a reasonable person would have done, regardless of whether the wife was frightened.
It becomes a question.
Sure. Yeah. And of course, you see, the commission, there was no question that we were going to recognize the defense of duress. The question was, well, who had the burden of establishing it? And I believe it was on a 7-5 vote, we said it's an affirmative defense.
Yeah.
So.
I'm surprised.
Well. they went that way. Okay, the final thing, because I don't think I can go any further, is entrapment. And that's section 250 at the very bottom. And all we have done here is we codified the Supreme Court's decision, the Alaska Supreme Court's decision in Grossman. And in Grossman, they set forth the test as it follows, almost verbatim in the code. And we classified it as an affirmative defense. And in this instance, there's no question that it's constitutional because the Supreme Court, less than 2 months ago, in Alaska said entrapment is an affirmative defense. So what we've done is we've codified existing law. And under existing law, it is the defense of entrapment, whether a person was enforced, was entrapped by the police officer, for example, who engaged in conduct, is tried by the judge. It will continue to be tried by the judge under the code. We simply wanted to set it forth so it'd be easier to find.
I don't have a lot of
I think it said that you're going to have to show a little more action on the peace officer in terms of the entrapping act before you're going to get a prostitute. If you could show that she would engage in an official course of prostitution.
She's been convicted of that, she knows she's been ordered to police and where to go, and actually, she wanted to. So.
Well, I don't know about that. I wouldn't go so far as that. The thing I'm thinking of is, like, you go over, you're a police officer, and you see this potential defendant, and you go sit next to her at a bar, and you say, "Hi, my name is Joe," and she says, let's go back
let's
to my
go,
place.
Joe.
And that's, I think what it's saying is that's not entrapment, because the only person that would have responded to that act would be the person engaged in habitual course of conduct. We did not resolve this. We did not write this language. The Supreme Court did, and I imagine that in cases they'll expand further.
No, sir, I didn't even know that they'd ever written one that broad.
Okay, it's Grossman.
Meeting adjourned. Very good. Good overtime.
The House Judiciary Committee meeting of January 16th, 1978, was adjourned at 4:55 p.m. House Judiciary Committee meeting
It's a delayed reaction.
Yeah.
Hello?
Hello.
Say something, Barry.
You got a lot of stuff to do.
Man, this is weird. Totally weird.
Try talking into it.
What do you mean?
Are you hearing a conversation?
Yeah, with that on your ear.
Oh, that's weird.
Is it picking up, though?
Yeah.
You better pull the mic off there, but hear itself. Okay. We're gathered here again on the 10 to draft 5, page 13. No. Oh, page 23. I'm sorry. Okay. 23. No microphone?
There is. I'm hiding it.
Is everybody in between know Ann Carpenetti? Yeah. Okay, I didn't know. She, Ann, sat in a lot of community meetings, her sitting in the Attorney General's office. So she's very familiar with this case. Page
2
there.
It's 4.
It's
4. 5.
It's
there.
Still on part 4? 5.
Oh, I don't know if you have
calculations. No, I only have part 4. It's easy. Okay.
Well, here's 4. My part of 4 is gone. And here's 5. Yeah, we're working on 5.
Is this part 4 that I have?
Yeah, there's only one version.
maybe it's over there.
Page 23 in part 5.
We have a mixed bag today because I'm hoping to cover insanity, bag checks, littering, deceptive business practices, and credit card offenses. Don't ask me what the common thread is, except they were all in this book.
Sorry to revise your statute today.
On page 23, we have the code sections on responsibility, which are basically mental disease or defect. Now, there are no changes in existing law in these provisions. These statutes were adopted by the legislature in 1972 when they revised the insanity statute, and the commission basically took the approach that they weren't going to look at it. That is a fairly controversial subject or complex, and the legislature gave it significant attention in 1972. What we did do is we made three minor language changes that are described in page 24 and 25. And for example, existing law refers to a state of mind. In the code, we use the term culpable mental state, so we simply made a change. There are no substantive changes in this provision. Let me also point out, to make this clear, currently, provisions regarding insanity appear in Title 12 of the criminal statutes. What we did is we took out basically two statutes from those, I think 10 provisions, and we moved it to the criminal code because it deals with the substantive effect of insanity as opposed to the procedural effect. In other words, what happens when you're convicted, you're found not guilty by reason of insanity. Those provisions remain outside the criminal code. Well, we moved into the criminal code where the two statutes you see here, which simply say that you're not responsible for criminal conduct if you suffering from mental disease or defect. And again, it's no change. We simply moved it from Title 12 to 11 because that's where it belongs. Procedural aspects of insanity in terms of, again, how you're committed, where, what kind of observations you have to undergo, that remains in Title 12, no changes.
Additionally, not only did the commission, as a general point of view on other issues in this, say that they weren't going to try to review something the legislature had recently addressed and made policy decision on, but additionally, that was so if nobody brought to our attention that there was a problem with existing law then. And I think that was the case with this. Nobody was complaining about the existing law. Is there any questions on that?
Why the prohibition, whether it's this code or existing law, against bringing up evidence of mental disease?
I'm sorry, the prohibition?
Yeah. It's not admissible. Lines 20 through 24.
Oh,
it's not admissible unless the defendant brings it. Why would there be a prohibition against that?
My initial reaction is simply that it's a very difficult defense to both prove and to disprove, and I think you want to give notice to the prosecution so they're aware that this is part of the defendant's case.
Yeah, but why couldn't the prosecution bring it up? It says, essentially say that the defendant must raise that as a defense and the prosecution may not? Why may not the prosecution raise that point?
Well, why would the defense would go to the innocence of the defendant. In other words, I didn't.
Yeah, I'm turning it around now.
I'm not too sure. Maybe
I think
help me out.
Your answer is why the prosecution couldn't bring it up to show perhaps that this person was more likely to commit the offense as a part of the state's proof.
Yeah.
And the reason courts generally don't allow that is it's fairly prejudicial. Courts generally find that evidence of prior bad acts or other factors which would tend to show that the defendant is just a bad person is not admissible. What you're trying to prove is that the defendant did this particular act.
Okay, so this goes under the theory that you're being charged with this crime and whatever you've done before, it doesn't really wash.
Yeah, unless there are certain instances where prior bad acts or the history of the defendant is admissible, but it's very limited, especially in this state. It's really limited.
You just don't want
to prove that
sentence.
Somebody committed a crime because he's a bad person, or he has been a bad person. I mean, you can use evidence that the person has committed crimes for which he's been convicted, if it's within the last 5 years, if it's a crime involving false statement or
that is admissible, you said.
Yeah.
If the defendant takes a stand, not if the defendant is undergone formal treatment for a mental disorder, would that be admissible?
Probably not, because it's not really relevant. And it was for you're trying to say that the state might want to introduce evidence that the guy's crazy and therefore the guy's more likely to commit a crime. Well, that doesn't necessarily follow.
Why wouldn't that be relevant?
Well,
if in fact it's true.
Why is it relevant? Was it relevant that your mother was crazy?
If that's an inheritable trait, I suspect it is.
What about your grandfather?
It's an inheritable trait.
You're saying that the state is going to want to introduce evidence of the person's mental disease or defect to make a jury believe that he did the crime, but I mean, that kind of evidence, if you introduce it, puts into the whole issue the issue of insanity, and then the state, in a sense, would have to disprove it.
Wouldn't there be cases where the state, maybe I'm just taking up too much of it. Wouldn't there be cases where the state may not want to go after, prosecute criminally, but may want to lock the guy up?
Well, that's something. Then they would go under 47.
Yeah,
civil commission. You wouldn't, they wouldn't just bring a charge.
Well, what would they do in that case?
They would move under Title 47, which we kind of touched on briefly, to have the person committed. And they would have to convince the court that he was paying for himself and others.
Okay.
I could just maybe discuss it with you later on if you want to.
Okay.
Page 26.
Okay.
Has anybody ever done this?
Never. Well, just yesterday, I got a lot of them.
Issuing a bad check is a crime that a number of commission members felt you don't even need in the criminal code. And let me give you some reason why. Under common law concepts of theft, a promise to do something in the future would not be indictable as a form of theft. It would only cover promises to do something in the past or existing statements. Now, when you write a check to someone, it's viewed as a promise to pay the person at the time he pays the check. When he goes to the bank to obtain payment for the check. Now, you could broaden that and say it's also a representation that at the time you have the funds in your account, but that's somewhat difficult. Anyway, so under common law, it's generally been held that writing a bad check does not qualify as theft because it's a representation as to a future event. Now, under the code, we've eliminated that doctrine. We say representations as to future events as well as existing or present events would give rise to a charge of theft if it turns out the representation is false and you acted with an intent to deceive. Okay, so if you've eliminated that concept, then you could deal with the person that writes a bad check knowing that there are no funds there in at the time he writes it and with an intent not to put the funds in before he gets to the payee cashes the check. You could deal with that kind of conduct as a form of theft. In other words, you made a false representation that there would be money when you cashed the check. There wasn't money, you obtained property, that's theft. Even in cases where you write the check and the say the merchant calls up the bank and finds out that there was no money there, that conduct would be attempted theft. Further, when we covered scheme to defraud last week, we found that if you engage in conduct constituting a scheme to defraud 10 or more persons and you obtain property from any one of those persons, you're going to be guilty of a B felony. So under the code, the person that writes a series of bad checks during a single course of conduct conceivably could be punished for a B felony. Well, with that in mind, the question comes up, why do you need a bad check statute? The reason you need a bad check statute, I guess the best example is that we have one. People just are familiar with bad check statutes, and we should continue that. And there also may be instances where the conduct of the bad check writer really doesn't amount to theft, but you want to ensure public confidence in negotiable instruments. Let me give you one example. Say you write a bad check, and at the time you know that there's no money in the account to cover the check, but you're intending to put the money in before the check is cashed. Well, for some reason, let's say it's an innocent reason, you're
the money that you had is stolen and you can't get to the bank to put the money in, well, under the bad check statute, you would be guilty of issuing a bad check. We're saying you're writing a bad check, it's at your peril. If you put the money in on time, it's not criminal. If you don't get to the bank in time, it is. Now, what the crime prohibits on page 26, line 6, is the act of uttering a check knowing that you or your principal have insufficient funds for the drawee to cover the check. And in addition, payment has to be refused by the drawee upon presentation. This changes existing law somewhat in the sense that under existing law, the mere utterance of a check knowing that you don't have sufficient funds would be a criminal act. It's never prosecuted, but in fact it is a criminal act. And I know myself, I think most people on the commission also have engaged in that kind of conduct, writing a check, mailing it out of state, knowing you're going to get to the bank and putting the money in. So what we've done in the code is we've defined the crime to require that payment be refused when it's presented. Now, the culpability requirement for this is knowing that you or your principal have insufficient funds for the drawee to cover the check. Now, subsection B provides that when you draw a check and you do have insufficient funds with the drawee to cover it at the time of the utterance, you are presumed, rebuttably presumed, to know of the insufficiency. And that's just based on the fact that people are presumed to know what's in their checking account, and you could make that rebuttable presumption, saying that if you write a check and there was insufficient funds at the time you wrote it, you are rebuttably presumed to know you had the insufficiency. Now,
in the order, it was gone fast enough that I didn't catch it all, but are we overlooking something? That is, that if a teller at a bank makes an error, does the making of that error render an act non-criminal that would otherwise be criminal? Because you're saying that one of the elements of the offense is that he utters a check and payment is refused by the drawee upon presentation. Okay, if the money's not really there and he knows it's not really there and they do their job right, they check, I'm sorry, there's not sufficient funds to get the check back, and there's a crime. Teller makes an error, accepts the check, you don't have the element of the offense, and there's no crime. Are you going to have criminality turn upon a clerical error by a bank teller?
I would think in the hypothetical, perhaps, that eventually it would be...
You know, bank tellers are not very hypothetically erroneous. They make lots of mistakes lots of times.
Insofar as that hypothetical, would occur, I think that payment does have... You have to prove as an element that payment is refused by the drawee upon presentation. Now, you could argue that eventually when they do find out about it, I'd have to check the UCC on that, but perhaps when there is an error, it doesn't qualify as a acceptance of it. Now,
you don't necessarily incorporate UCC definitions by reference.
Anyway. Oh, I understand that.
And I think that words somehow other than what you've done in line 9 are necessary.
Unless just their payment is properly refused, or
is refused, or perhaps upon presentation or in due course or whatever the appropriate reference to banking procedures are.
Mm-hmm. That's a good. No one in the commission did give out that hypothetical, but it's an interesting. Okay. I'll try to slow down a little bit too.
Lisa?
Perhaps there are reasons for it, but it seems to me that this, more than a lot of other sections, is really burdened with a whole lot of words that don't mean anything except in this section, like uttering a check and dishonoring by the check.
We could. You're right. Utter is a term I think that has been. We could use issuing the fine issue on subsection 4. I don't think that's really a problem. I think once we had issues, I think someone took exception to that people think of it as uttering, when, you know, judges and attorneys think of it as uttering. I don't know what the public thinks of it as.
I don't know what the public thinks of uttering. It's a word that's involved.
Isn't the current law very different?
Excuse me?
That is, that if I forge a check and give it to you and you know that it's forged and you cash it,
both of us are guilty of uttering a forged document under current law.
Well, you would be guilty of, under, and this has gone in the commentary, and when I, before you, I think, came in, I was saying that the commission basically, there were significant numbers of the people that didn't want on the commission, didn't want to have a statute like this at all. What we did is we just dealt with the person that draws it himself.
But you still deal with that criminality, otherwise, so there's still...
Sure, I addressed that specifically in the commentary, and I point out that the code provision only applies to the drawer, the person that writes the check. The person who passes the check, knowing of the insufficiency, can be prosecuted for theft, attempted theft, or be acting in concert with the issuer as an accessory to the crime of attempted theft. There is no need to make a specific reference there to the passer.
All right. Being new to this revision, what has been the position of the subcommission on using plain English vis-a-vis legal argot? Has any effort been made to use plain English?
Plain English vis-a-vis argot.
I think throughout the revision we have. I agree that the uttering portion is, like, for example, I mean, times we've done this, is an existing law, there's 26 terms that you use to denote the mental state of the actor, like surreptitiously, willfully. We use 4 terms. We don't use terms like deliberate premeditated malice. I guess.
Or evincing a malignant heart.
I don't think it's used in a statute. But insofar as that uttering is a legalese term, we may have made a mistake there.
Then there's been an effort to insert plain English in.
One of the primary goals of the revision has been to try to make the law explainable to the citizen as well as peace officers, judges, and attorneys. In the assault sections, for example, existing law never defines what an assault is. They simply say a person who assaults another person. In the code, we specifically say assault is an intent to cause physical injury. You cause physical injury, you know, is one example. So I think we've really cut down the legalese. Uttering maybe a holdover.
This committee wrote the current law on assault, sir.
Yes, don't tread on any toes.
We
did have to compromise.
I have to, most recent assault amendments, I have to say, the aggravated assault statute was clear in terms of what covered, but we didn't change the assault battery provision. So we've really had attempts to make it simpler terms throughout.
Would now be the time to ask for that, or is it being introduced in this language?
Well, I made a note that uttering should be changed to issue. We didn't change the assault battery provision. We've really had attempts to make it simpler terms throughout.
Would now be the time to ask for that, or is it being introduced in this language?
Well, I made a note that uttering should be changed to issuing.
And also on line 16, I think the phrase within 10 days after dishonor of the draw by the drawee ought to be changed, if it's possible, to within 10 days after payment is refused. Is there a difference? Dishonor is not a term you use, whereas you use payment is refused up on line 10. It seems to me there's some other language in here. I don't like this business on line 11, the drawer or representative drawer. Wouldn't it be possible just to say the person who signs the check is rebuttably presumed to know of that insufficiency?
One second.
The witness, the representative drawer.
That is defined. We could use one term.
No, but I mean, it's just so cumbersome to read it. I know it's defined.
Yeah.
But just aren't you really saying the person who signs the check? Whether it's the person who's the prime. What?
This whole section is.
It's really burdensome. I mean, it's really.
I'll cleanse myself by saying that this isn't my statute. I will cleanse myself by saying that this isn't my statute.
Line 20 is reportedly authorized.
Did any members of the subcommission or attention to make Cardozo's essay on legal language and methodology of statute writers and judges?
Well, let's put it this way. Most of the members of the commission went to law school except for me.
Most of them go to Columbia.
Let me tell you what the problem.
Let
me tell you what the problem is with the statute. The problem is that the person that originally drafted, for some very crazy reason, took it from Massachusetts. Massachusetts is the only statute that's really based on Massachusetts law. Massachusetts relies very heavily on common law terms. returns, and it's reflected here. I did come back with a redraft of it, because I think you pointed out.
This is a general thing that what happened here was that we had, before Barry started working for us in the early days of COVID, we had somebody else working for us, and it didn't work out too well for a lot of different reasons. But anyway, so there was a certain amount of work that the commission had did, and the commission didn't want to start all over and, you know, do it all over. So Barry has gone over and, you know, cleaned up some. But this was one that's
there's some other problems with it too. What's costs and fees on line 15?
Yeah. So that anyway, that
I can come back with the redraft.
What's the New York penal law and Illinois penal law and the model penal code on the same subject? Why do we have to use Massachusetts?
All right, I will get to New York. Anyway, let me just go through subsection C though, because at least let me explain the concept on it. Subsection C says it is an affirmative defense that the defendant or a person acting on his behalf makes full satisfaction of the amount of check with costs and fees within 10 days after dishonored by the drawee. Says if you get the check back and it's been dishonored, and you go to the bank, you give, you provide the money that's necessary to cover it, it's an affirmative defense to prosecution. Under existing law, you can still be charged with it, with the crime. What we do is we make essentially restitution to the bank.
Bert Lance is moving to Alaska.
It's a fairly common type of provision. But anyway, that's subsection C. Sorry.
Insufficient funds means no funds.
Is it not really?
Yeah, I'm out.
Huh?
I will try.
You just walk up to the guy on the street and quickly say, insufficient funds means no funds.
Okay, I have another question since I'm going to be redrafting it. For some very strange reason, Massachusetts only refers to checks. They don't, existing law refers to check, draft, or other order drawn upon a bank. Do you want to make this limited to checks, or do you want to make it broader?
It should at least be as broad as existing law. We don't want to be accused of being a bunch of criminal coders,
well,
I have to say.
Okay, I could use that term, check, draft, or order drawn upon a bank.
What other kind of checks do you make?
Well, you see, a check is only something that is drawn upon a bank. Apparently, you could write, maybe someone can help you on this, but I think you could write other drafts that are not necessarily drawn upon a bank, but are rather a promise to pay that constitute negotiable instruments. The UCC uses four terms to define what a negotiable instrument is, and check is only one of them. We could simply say a negotiable instrument and refer to the UCC definition, as some states do.
Let's also check to see what other jurisdictions and multi-million dollar commissions have done with regard to that.
Oh, no, that's what I'm saying. So
jumping in and doing it.
Yeah.
But our existing law doesn't do check.
No, it doesn't. For some reason, and you know, maybe you can help me on that, because our statute just limited checks.
Fred? Mr. Chairman, I hesitate to ask, but are there any other sections that were taken from Massachusetts?
I'll answer that. No,
okay.
It's the only one.
Yeah. And my comment will be a lot shorter. Ever since Justice Story in 1835 started doing his draft of a criminal code for Massachusetts, there's been, and Harvard Law School started venting its spleen, Massachusetts has always contended that it is different, even down to differences familiar to lawyers between which great scholar on contract law you cite and all of that. Massachusetts, like Georgia, insists on being incredibly different in all kinds of areas of the law. And most of Alaska's law derives indirectly from New York and directly from Oregon, California, and Washington State, and from our strange own history. And we ought to stay consistent with our history, in my opinion. Since California and Oregon and New York have spent a hell of a lot of money on criminal code revisions lately.
Consistency is the contrast.
I should also point out the Massachusetts revised code did not pass.
Too many Harvard lawyers in the Massachusetts.
I think you made a little clear about that. Moving right along. Could you change insufficient funds means no funds on line 21?
You don't think it's necessary?
It's fun.
Well, actually, something like that.
Grammatical.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll change a lot.
Well, I certainly never go to Harvard Law School after seeing what the.
No, Yale, yeah, worse,
though. Where'd you go?
Michigan.
He's half of me, he's half of me.
Okay. But I got for a headlock.
He's Harvard.
He sure is. goes fishing with his kids out in the bush, and they're all wearing hardwood sweatshirts. It's just incredible.
I mean, let's try page 32.
Page 32 is our littering statute. Littering is currently, as I point out in the commentary on page 33, is a fairly limited prohibition in existing law in that it only prohibits throwing garbage on a highway, highway right-of-way, or a public recreational facility, or throwing it from a highway or highway right-of-way. So it only covers that type of conduct. What we did is we made the offense of littering if you recklessly place or throws litter on any public or private property or in any public or private waters without the consent of the owner and does not immediately remove it. We defined littering very broadly, includes any foreign substance, whatever kind of description. We gave some specific examples, glass, cans, bottles.
Mr. Chairman.
And we made littering a violation. It's not a crime. It's only punishable by fine.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I wonder if Mr. Stern remembers the old instrumentality thing that we talked about in part of the code last year, where stick, pipe, dirk, and thing, and other thing, remember that?
Mm-hmm.
And if you check Justice Cardozo's essay and check your definition of litter, it sure comes out the same way. And,
yeah, Opal.
I mean, and all that Opal.
Although Opal, you know,
I mean, you've got, can't you get a generalized thing rather than listing everything in an agglutinative method? And I got a chance to use it in 1978.
Well, the definition implies that all of those things that are listed, the rubber, statues, garbage, Opal, and so on, are foreign substances, so you could just cut them off and say litter means any foreign substance of whatever kind or description, whether or not it's a good value.
No, I think that's fine. Yeah, we don't need the specific references.
Yeah.
I think it was kind of an add-on by the commission in terms of let's think about the stuff you could put, you know, cans, bottles, or any foreign substance.
Barry?
Yeah.
Could you remind me what recklessly means?
Yeah. Okay, first, backing up somewhat, just to do this, since it's a violation and it's only punishable by a fine, the code provides that you don't necessarily have to prove culpability in the actor. In other words, all you have to do is show that as a result of some act, the person put litter on one of the places listed, regardless of whether he even knew about it. Okay, the commission decided to require some form of culpability, and the culpability that required was reckless. And reckless is defined in the following manner.
It's worse than negligent.
It's worse, it's more serious. The person acts recklessly with respect to a result, and that's what we're talking about. You're engaging in conduct, and the result is that litter is put on the floor. When you are aware of and consciously disregard a substantial and unjustifiable risk that the result will occur, the risk must be of such a nature and degree that disregard of it constitute a gross deviation from the standard of conduct that a reasonable person would observe in the situation. Period. So the person has to be aware of a substantial risk that he will litter. Most of these cases, you assume it will be intentional. It's difficult for me to come up with a case of littering where it's not an intentional littering. Perhaps the best example might, you might be thinking of yourself.
You mean he doesn't have to be aware that he's breaking the law? He just has to be aware that he's throwing something on the ground.
He has to not care whether he's breaking the law. I think that's the best way of describing my understanding, at least, of recklessly.
It is never an element of the under any crime of the code that you know that the conduct is a violation of law. Ignorance of the law is no defense. All you have to be aware of and disregard the risk is what your conduct is going to do. And the conduct here is referring to causing a result, and that is placing the litter on the ground. Now, certainly, and we also have the general provision that says if recklessly is the culpable mental state that you specify, if you prove that it was done intentionally, that's sufficient, of course. So this says it doesn't have to be an intentional littering per se. It could be something just reckless. And perhaps the example I could give you is the person that loads up loads his truck with all kinds of garbage, and he doesn't tie it down. And he's driving along, and his stuff goes flying out the back, and it litters the whole highway. Mm-hmm. Under those circumstances, he would not have intentionally littered. But nevertheless, the jury would find that he disregarded a substantial and unjustifiable risk.
That's reckless.
Exactly. So
So, and again, the important thing to note, though, is that since it's a violation and the only penalty is a fine, we don't have to require anything in terms of culpability. We could provide that if you're driving down the highway and you took all reasonable grounds to ensure that the litter would not come out, you would nevertheless be liable. We could do that. We did it.
Larry?
Is that why you went from a misdemeanor to a violation?
Terry, you could help me on that. I'm not really sure. You know, you could take this in a number of approaches. If you made it intentionally, you probably would justify, you know, making it an A misdemeanor. What we did, or a B misdemeanor. Certainly, the fact that we're not requiring it to be done intentionally and only recklessly, perhaps just for maybe not making survivability otherwise treated as a violation, this is a lower form of culpability. I recall that the commission was, you know, took different approaches as to this, whether it would be strict liability or not. What we did do, however, and we'll get to that tomorrow, is we dealt with a form of littering as a, basically an aggravating factor, and that is called obstruction of highways. Yeah, and in that circumstance, say the logger or the say the person that's bringing the trash to the dump is carrying a set of glass, for example, and the glass falls out. Under those circumstances, we treated that as a misdemeanor offense.
I noted in the commentary that that's a big misdemeanor, but I think that in my mind this is a downgrading of of littering, and I think in the public's mind you could upgrade it.
Okay. Just in terms of how it is treated today, there wouldn't be the same broad prescription against it, because if, under existing law, it would only cover material thrown onto the highway or material thrown off the highway as you're driving by. And certainly one approach here is to perhaps require intentional and upgrade it as a misdemeanor, or just upgrade it and require recklessly. You've got a whole different approaches. Certainly the fact, I think that the fact is that if we're making it a violation, we probably shouldn't require any form of culpability here. In other words, strict liability. And we may, in fact, downgrade it.
Well, being a person who's not terribly fond of strict liability, I would tend to want to upgrade it, because I think that if there's anything upon which there's some unanimity in this state, it's littering. And I think that the fact that we have to prove something is well and good. That's the desirable feature of law for me. But I sure have a tendency to not downgrade this.
There would be no problem simply just saying littering is a misdemeanor and leaving the statute exactly as it is, recklessly.
I can see us changing all the signs throughout the state which says littering is a fine of $300 instead of $500. Isn't that what they say now?
I'm not really certain. And you see, I'm not too certain that you, in fact, constitutionally can perhaps give a $500 fine. There's some, and I'm not too sure whether the statute requires...
Is the maximum on violation $300?
That's correct.
So if, in fact, the sign did say up to $500, what do you do then?
They've all been shot up already, so it doesn't matter.
That's a very interesting point.
Because they simply change the word and then I'm charging $500.
Yeah.
What you say they wouldn't do.
I think, frankly, even if we make it a B misdemeanor, the fine for a B misdemeanor may exceed $500 under the code. Anyway.
May exceed $500.
Yeah, so we may have to change the signs anyway.
No. You would have to change it up to $500. Okay.
In other words, we may authorize a $1,000 fine. I'm not too sure. I don't remember what we did for B misdemeanors.
Okay. Other questions on littering?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, ma'am.
I hope Barry will jump in when I'm pontificating if I say something that's obviously misleading. I just want to go over that thing again. At least I want to be able to have a kind of a crude but not totally inaccurate way of describing our levels of culpability. I think that, I'm just trying to develop the shorthand in my head. Somebody asked me about this code or something. That we have ordinary negligence, which is, you know,
we don't have that.
We don't have that anymore. Not even negligent driving.
Not in the criminal code.
Okay.
The criminal code is not in the
code. That in the statute where it is now. Okay.
Exactly.
Okay, but at least something to make a reference to, because people have been on juries and they've heard about that. And that's whatever 12 people think is unreasonable for a guy to do in the context of his own business if he's looking after his own tail. And then recklessly is something worse when they basically, they just don't care what the result is, or they don't intend the result.
No. The difference between recklessly and criminal negligence.
I'm not trying to be surgical, I'm trying to be not.
Okay, the only difference between recklessly and criminal negligence is that the criminally negligent person is not aware that his conduct will create a result, whereas the reckless person is aware but disregards the risk.
Okay. I don't think there's two questions. Okay, well, if you can be criminally negligent if you're not aware, then when do you become aware?
It's when you're reckless.
But if you're criminally negligent but not reckless, it presumes that you become aware of the consequences of your action only after the fact. Is that what you're saying?
No, you have to, under both reckless, you have to be aware of it at the time you're engaging.
I'm talking about negligence.
Okay. For criminal negligence, you don't have...
When do you ever become aware of it?
It doesn't matter. It's at the time you're engaging in the conduct. You fail to perceive it. It doesn't matter later on.
If you're criminally negligent, you don't know it's happened. It could happen, but it's a negligent standard. It's at least something like the one.
Gross negligence.
Yeah. And the reckless thing is you're likely to know what's going to happen, and you don't give
a damn.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That's the playback from Fred yesterday.
No, that's coming from out there.
When you take
it, that's exciting. But they're not saying
is it the coffee pot?
Yeah.
You sure?
But then you go, what, no way
you ran out of water?
Intentionally.
I just poured some cold water in.
It's crying.
But the question is, whether the
thing,
according to what you're saying, since the mics are over there, and the mics are just
checking out.
For Representative Carpenter's information, the thing is that we only use four terms in the code to denote the culpable mental state, that the actor must act when he doesn't act. In other words, to be guilty of first-degree murder now, you have to do it with deliberate and premeditated malice.
That's cool. What
we simply use four terms to denote that type of term, and we say intentionally, knowingly, recklessly, criminal negligence. And criminal negligence is the least serious culpable mental state, and intentional being the most serious. And we set up degrees in the code, depending on a lot of times, what was the culpability of the actor. So if a person intentionally causes serious physical injury, he's going to be treated more seriously than the person that recklessly causes serious physical injury. And we either specify in each statute the culpable mental state, or it applies through a general rule of culpability, which says, even if we don't specify it, it applies, and here's how it applies. So that's one of the most, that really, you don't really notice it as we go through each statute, but it's one of the most important things in the code, I consider, in terms of, number one, in terms of consistency, and number two, it's just making it easier to understand. So when you try reading it, it's you say, what does that mean? But under existing law, you really need to get to the issue of deciding, well, what does that term mean, because it's not defined. No one knows what it means.
I want to go through this colloquy with you a couple times more before the same on the floor, because yeah. I want to have a little shorthand to talk about those four elements of culpability. And that's the general part which is supposed to be.
We'll make sure it happens. Yeah. We send you and Barry down to a private seminar at the Red Dog.
I just asked my secretary to try to get a copy of Lambert Williams' Criminal Law, the general part. Do you have a copy of it?
No, I do not. I just have Perkins.
I don't read it. You know, I can't find it.
Okay. Page 35.
No, okay. See. He started it, and then went to Wexler, and then went to all the state divisions. And that's where this whole methodology comes from.
All right, page 35.
Okay, now we have the blackboard.
Scroll back to the blackboard. Quit down.
Can you leave the court after? You're here for that court, don't you?
This is Representative Dankworth asked me to remind him when we got to the area of deceptive business practices. So, for the record,
you're addressing your teacher.
We're doing it now. In the provisions that start at 35, we have offenses against business and commercial offenses. We looked at some of those in TD4. Now we're up to the last five statutes. Now, the important thing to remember is they're all A misdemeanors, and the primary offense is called deceptive business practices, and it prohibits six forms of conduct. Now, the important thing to stress is that the conduct prohibited in the statute is now regulated by numerous provisions outside Title 11. The
three main provisions are the Consumer Protection Act, the Weights and Measures Act, and the Food and Drug Act. So it's not that we're just going into this area and putting criminal penalties on this conduct. They're now subject to criminal penalties. We're simply consolidating them and bringing them into Title 11, where they probably should be. Now, upon passage of the code, it's intended that the criminal penalties now under the Consumer Protection Act applicable to this type of conduct would be repealed. As a matter of fact, as part of the bill that will be introduced, it repeals the criminal penalties applicable to the Consumer Protection Act. So when you're dealing with crimes involving business frauds, you're dealing under the criminal code and not the Consumer Protection Act. Okay. Six forms of conduct are prohibited under the Deceptive Business Practices Statute. The first is basically false advertising. The second is making false material statements in connection with the sale of property or services. The third is false weights, possessing or using false weights. The fourth is selling or offering for sale less than the represented amount of the commodity. The fifth is selling or offering for sale adulterated commodities. And the sixth is selling or offering for sale mislabeled commodities. Now, in terms of culpability, which we were just discussing, the commission adopted an interesting approach to this, and I'm not too sure whether I approve or not. I debated. What we do initially is we say a crime is strict liability. You don't have to prove culpability. However, subsection B of the statute on line 28 says once you raise the issue of culpability, the prosecution must establish that you acted at least recklessly. So, in fact, every defendant is going to say culpability, and then the prosecution will be required to establish that the person acted at least recklessly. I probably would like to see it simply put recklessly right in there, because that is, in fact, what we're doing.
Mr. Chairman, two questions. First one, I just assume that I know the answer, but I always ask when you do this, when you say you're taking something else out. May I assume that you haven't decriminalized anything by the redraft and the pulling this out of the consumer protection as far as you and the commission know?
Okay, there's...
I mean, they haven't omitted something that is made an offense in current law.
Okay, what we did is we took out the general criminal penalty applying to the Consumer Protection Act, which applies to all 24 acts specified in the Consumer Protection Act. And that was basically after, the testimony or, conversations with people in the Consumer Protection Act division, Stan Fisher at the time, and the people that were working for him. That the approach would be that the criminal code would decide what specific forms of deceptive business practices should be criminal. And
is the answer to my question. Do you think you basically omitted anything in this new section that is made criminal in the present law?
I think the answer is yes, Barry, because some of those lists of 24 are not included here.
Well, Terry, but they...
Under existing law, they are criminal they're not included here.
The ones... If you look through it, I think that most of them are in fact covered by the false material statements. Now, I went through it this morning and I tried to try to make a list. But like, for example, one that's clearly not covered is falsely representing or designating the geographic or that is covered. There was something here about disparaging another person's product. Yeah, seven, disparaging the goods, services, or businesses of another by false or misleading representation or fact. Now, that's not covered under this section because it's not really false advertising or false statements in connection with the sale of property. But in conversations with the people in consumer protection, they felt that the only conduct that deserves criminal penalties are the ones that we included in the criminal code.
When we get to markup on this, can you do a check back against those 24 or 25?
Sure. Yeah.
And if there are more than one besides that, tell us what they are.
Sure.
My much more important question, I think, our hope is, looks to me like you're saying that, now you're saying commits the crime. Now, we just got this book today in the mail.
Yeah.
What is it, Class A misdemeanor?
Yeah, all these offenses here are A misdemeanors.
Okay, so it's a Class A misdemeanor with no culpability level.
No, I don't think that's accurate.
Unless you have another one that's applying from your general part, or you have this weird reverse culpability.
Yeah, I think it's wrong, frankly. I just,
you know, okay, what we did is initially we say the prosecution go and simply say there was a false advertisement. They don't have to prove any knowledge by the defendant. But then we have a provision that says once the defendant says, you have to prove my knowledge, then they have to prove it. Why don't we just say it, just put in recklessly or intentionally?
Also, although it may not, there'd be a question whether I'd be constitutionally infirm under present law, considering the drift of constitutional cases, I could see this being challenged or challengeable in 5 or 10 years if the law continues
the way
it has.
The point would be, of course, that what happens if the defendant doesn't raise the issue of his culpability and the state doesn't prove culpability, would that be a constitutional violation? I'm not too sure how that would work because the defendant did have the chance to bring up the issue. It's you know, I didn't want to mention that. I think, look, yeah, I agree that I think if in fact we are requiring culpability here, which we are, essentially, we should specifically say that and eliminate subsection B.
Mr. Chairman, Ann was raising her hand.
I just had a little comment. If you do leave this in, I don't think it makes sense the way it's worded.
Which one?
B, line 28. It is the defense of the prosecution.
Yeah.
That the defendant did not act at least.
It's a double negative.
I don't know. It's not right.
Okay.
You're right.
Mr. Chairman, there's a young lady working in the mail room with most of a PhD in English, and I'd be interested to have her opinion of the grammar and some of this stuff. Mr. Carpenter's journalistic ease might also add to it.
Are you suggesting we could trade you in?
What's that? I'm an engineer, sir. I was taught to be illiterate.
It worked.
Where's the double name? It doesn't sound right. I know that.
Sure.
Which line is this?
When you're using the negative form, you don't want to use at least.
We have
a list
of
offenses.
Where is
this?
On line 28 and 29 on page 35.
Yeah.
Well, I think the easy way of dealing with the problem is by, on line 12, just simply adding recklessly.
I don't know why we have Barry, do we have, Larry asked, remember the list we had that listed all the offenses in terms of what were A felonies and what were B?
Oh, yeah, I don't have that right now, but I can get it.
You have a little chart or something last year.
Sure. I Legislative Affairs has that.
Okay.
I made one up showing all the offenses, and I'll get it for tomorrow's meeting. But I'd like to, you know, if you feel like you'd like to see that in terms of the recklessly put in on line 12, that could save me the problem of trying to figure out did not act at least, which I don't like to begin with. In other words, we really want culpability here because we're saying once it's raised, you know, then this prosecution has to prove it. It's the only time we've ever adopted that approach. So,
why don't you have recklessness for your misdemeanor, and if you have criminal negligence, not criminal negligence.
Intentional.
Annoying. I was thinking maybe having, you know, you get a pretty wide range of horrible conduct here, but you're treating it all as a Class A misdemeanor. That's what I was wondering about.
What's the penalty for a Class A misdemeanor?
Up to a year. Now, under the existing Consumer Protection Act, it's, I believe, also up to a year.
Yeah.
But let me just check that.
Maybe there are some of these that should only be violations, and some, one or two, should be a felony.
You want to go through here and go through them in a little more detail? In terms of the sections?
Well, I read the sections.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to think of all the fact situations. You know, I can talk about hypotheticals forever.
A violation, Fred, would be something with no penalty. You know, an A misdemeanor, the way it's going to work, it's going to be, you know, it could all be suspended or it could just be a fine. So you still have the same range, but it's only that your maximum is higher. And the only...
But a violation is not a crime under the law, and a misdemeanor.
Right.
That's true.
Therefore, the person charged ends up with a criminal record in one case and without one in the other case.
Mm-hmm. Now, you see, okay, if you want to treat it as a I don't think that you should consider this as a violation, simply because if you want to deal with it as a civil matter, I think you want to leave it up to Consumer Protection. And they have the authority under 45 still to deal with it civilly in terms of getting an injunction, getting a fine.
Going up to the range of a felony, are there facts?
Going up to
a felony. 4:12 in the afternoon, I'm not going to try to invent a whole bunch of hypotheticals.
Yeah, well, I think if you're dealing with felony conduct, you should prosecute as a theft. If you can't establish the elements of theft or scheme to defraud, I don't think you need to deal with it
as a felony here. You're dealing here with probably conduct that isn't, you know, you assume that there wasn't property taken exceeding $500, because if there was, you would try to prosecute the person for theft, which is a C felony. And you see, this also covers stuff simply like exposing for sale, you know, property that's mislabeled when you're reckless as to whether it's mislabeled. It doesn't cover a completed
did
act.
Did you look at, Fred, were you here when we reviewed the scheme to defraud?
I was here when you started working on this section.
I think if you look
section
at that...
section had the book, but I bet you I wasn't in the room when you got to that section.
Yeah, I think take a look at that, because...
Do you think it's general enough to cover the bigger scheme?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's what it's specifically directed at.
Yeah.
And, you know, with when it's 10 or more people, it's a felony. And that's, it's you know, based on the federal mail fraud statute. And
that's what I was here then. No,
okay, so that's what it is directed at.
Suppose
you know, somebody that comes in as a professional schemer.
Then it's an automatic, okay, if you've got fewer than nine people, it's an A misdemeanor.
But still.
You see, well, right, there, maybe that points out that maybe in the scheme to defraud, we didn't pick the right aggravating factor. In other words, perhaps you should set a specific dollar figure, or perhaps the 10-person limitation on the felony is too high.
I think the 10-person, I think we're leaving something in the middle there for very bad conduct that we're only making a misdemeanor by adopting federal language in the same way in which you also proposed to do it for the gambling statute. When one of the reasons that the Congress has, one of the reasons that Congress has, say, for 10 or more people in their provision.
They don't.
I thought you said they did.
No, they don't.
Well, I know in the elements of the gambling provision, they've got the same ones that you've got.
Oh, yeah, the gambling's
and the reason they do that is so that they don't have to prosecute every damn one of them, even though they're really pretty serious crimes.
Mm-hmm.
Because they only want to get involved in the biggies in interstate commerce, which isn't our concern.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's a hole in here somewhere. Between your scheme to defraud and this class A misdemeanor, if you've got somebody defrauding fewer than 10,
okay, what you could, what
in
you
a serious
could do,
matter.
Fine. What you could do, the way to deal with that hole easily is to make scheme to defraud in the second degree involve schemes to defraud less than 10 persons. It's classified as an A misdemeanor. Perhaps you want to reclassify that as a C felony.
If you make a note on your forehead or something, you
is that appended draft 4?
Yes.
I'm going to have to turn into a pumpkin in about 30 seconds, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
My letter was here yesterday when I wasn't on gambling.
Yeah.
I suppose it was.
Okay, well, let's just stop here then.
Matter of fact, it's still out in the middle there, Fred.
Okay.
What did you all do with the gambling?
What scheme did you find?
Yeah, what did you do with gambling? Well, we said now we're off in the bushes.
Okay, we'll adjourn the meeting.
Okay. It's in 1141. It's in TD4.
Okay.
House Judiciary Committee meeting January 17th, adjourned at 4:15 p.m.